He may have been born in D.C., but John Warner is a Virginian through and through. A graduate of Washington and Lee and the University of Virginia, Warner served in the Navy as World War II came to a close, as a Marine during the Korean War, and later as Secretary of the Navy during the Vietnam War. In the mid-70s, Warner served as administrator for the American Revolution Bicentennial Administration, coordinating the celebration of our nation's 200th birthday. It was in that bicentennial year of 1976, public servant John Warner made public entertainment news, becoming Elizabeth Taylor's sixth husband. Warner was first elected to the U.S. Senate in 1978. During his five terms, he served on the Senate Armed Services Committee, including three stints as chairman. Retiring from public service after 30 years in the Senate, Warner had become the second longest-serving U.S. senator in state history. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, I feel very humbled that you would take the time to talk to the old boy.
Where are you calling us from?
I beg your pardon?
Where
I'm actually right now in the office of the Pew Trust. That's one of my principal clients. And I do a lot of work on energy and the environment, which interests me a great deal. And we just concluded a meeting here on that. And so this was a convenient time to get to you, and here we are.
I'd like to take you back to 1999 when you became the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, and that lasted all the way through 2007. But in your first years as chairman, there was the Kosovo War, the Iraq disarmament crisis, and of course in 2001, 9/11 happened. Were these defining years for you as chairman?
Very much so, because I worked closely with the president and the senior members of Congress, and the wars just engulfed so much of our activities in the Congress at that time. Particularly the Armed Services Committee was totally supported by the men and women of the armed forces, and once the president made decisions, we gave that support, and the involvement of the Security Council of the United Nations, and in other words, working with our global partners. You got to remember that the United States' basic defense policy is predicated on global participation in trying to preserve freedom. And I commend the first president, George Bush. He put together the 12 or so nations that repelled Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, and then the second George Bush, and then, of course, President Clinton. I worked very closely with him. They were always the global. We were the leader of the global community, very much so in the lead with others to preserve freedom.
Now, a lot of people may not remember, because your 30-year career as senator may have overshadowed this, but you did serve as Secretary of the Navy. Which role was most rewarding to you, being a senator or being the Navy Secretary?
Well, I was Secretary of the Navy for over 5 years. It was one of the longer periods for an individual to stay in those offices that long. But I enjoyed it. It was a tremendous challenge. It was during a tragic chapter in American military history, the war in Vietnam, because we had no bravery of our forces engaged in that war matched the bravery that men and women have shown that have worn the uniform since our republic was formed. But the Vietnam War was one that was not fully supported here on the home front, unlike World War II, to somewhat lesser extent, the Korean conflict. But there was a lot of dissension. And unfortunately, the men and women in uniform, particularly sadly when they returned from the battlefronts, were not as warmly greeted back home as my generation was in World War II and in the Korean conflict.
And I want to ask you about World War II in just a second, but would you say that while you were serving in your Senate years that you looked back fondly on your role as Navy Secretary, or even maybe wished that you were doing that again?
Well, I would simply say, and I don't in any way claim to be an American hero, certainly not in terms of my wearing the uniform. I did exactly what was expected of a young sailor, 17, turned 18, and I think I was 19 when I left the Navy. It was the final year of World War II. At that time, we had no expectation that the war would end so quickly, but it did. I won't dwell on that. But then in the Korean War, I was a young officer with the Marines, and I did spend a period in Korea. But the point is, those experiences were a privilege for me, and they laid the foundations, as if you were building a building, the footings that go in and get the permanency of the structure. Those privileged opportunities to serve with and learn from your fellow sailors and Marines, in my case, was just invaluable in putting together such a career as I did in the years to follow.
Now take us to World War II. You were 17 years old. Why did you decide to enlist then?
Well, you've got to remember that a young 17-year-old in World War II, first place, you were living in your own villages and communities. You didn't, your family basically, as a consequence of the Depression in the 30s, and so what, we didn't have a lot of travel. We lived in the community, we knew our communities, and when they put that poster up, join the Navy and see the world, it was a very exciting challenge. And of all the 17-year-old boys on my block, we just couldn't wait to enlist and go on and join our older brothers and a few instances sisters and the fellows on the block that had served and come back. And then, of course, sadly, on my block, I can still close my eyes, remember the doors. You put up a gold star if you'd lost a son in that war, and it was right there for all to see on the block, that gold star. Then there was a little placard that was put up, proudly, my son or our children or one of them are in this Navy and Marines or whatever it was. The whole of the country was united together in World War II. Not only those of us in uniform, but back on the home front. People, when I tell my children, they're all grown now, but I used to try and explain, we had gas rationing, food rationing, clothing rationing, all sorts of things, but the community of people in your villages and towns and cities across this country and on the farmlands of America, we were all united in one effort to preserve the freedom of this country.
I want to fast forward, if I may, and
yes,
go to the mid-70s. You met Elizabeth Taylor, and you were married to her for 6 years. Now, this was before you had become a U.S. senator.
That's correct.
What was going on in your life then?
Well, actually, it was rather interesting. The Queen, one of my jobs in the Bicentennial, which was a fascinating opportunity for me to, I visited every state in the United States to promote and provide some federal funding to have their own programs of choice individually in the state. Federal government, I said flatly, will not dictate or dominate how each state wishes to celebrate the 200th anniversary. You can understand Virginia, where the founding fathers and others emanated. There were many exciting celebrations. But then you'd go to the far west, where places were joined the Union much later and so forth. It was less emphasis. But anyway, it worked out beautifully. And I also traveled to 22 different foreign nations in connection with their gifts to America in recognition of our 200th anniversary. So it was a very broadening experience, and that too contributed to the foundation, my excitement, to try and become a member of Congress. And
is that how you met Elizabeth Taylor, was through
those efforts? Well, I was going to finish. Each of the heads of the 22 states that gave gifts visited the United States, and the president would receive them, and I would be a part of the ceremonies, you know, standing behind the principals, but nevertheless help organizing it. The last visitor was the Queen, and as a part of her guest list was Elizabeth, and I sort of had a blind date with Elizabeth when the Queen gave a party at the British Embassy to honor our president, vice president, secretary of state, and so forth. There were 100 people there. I'll never forget the night, and was very cordial, and she loved to see the Virginia countryside, and I allowed how, and I'd be happy to escort her around, because Virginia reminded her so much of her beloved England. And so eventually it did work into a marriage, and I have remained good friends with her and talked with her till shortly before she passed on, could no longer really have conversations. And yes, we did split up, but we didn't do it in anger. We did it in reality, that she wanted to go back and make movies and be on the theater all over the world, and I was in the U.S. Senate, and I couldn't be actively a husband in various parts of the world at the same time. So we had a friendly parting, but we saw each other on occasion after that on a number of times, and always conversed at various periods of the year, Christmas and our birthdays and so forth.
During those years,
she's a great woman. She really was an extraordinary person.
During those years of your marriage from 76 to 82, do you feel that she did acclimate to Washington life but just wanted something else?
No, she didn't really like it. I mean, the Senate runs on its own schedule. You never know when you're going to get home for dinner, in those days anyway. You didn't know whether you'd have to work on the weekends, and she did like to plan and do things. And so she just, about two-thirds of the way through our marriage, I guess it was the fourth or fifth year or something, she said, you know, I've just got to go back and do what I know how to do best and enjoy the most. And so she started on the stage, her first entry, and then in more movies. And I would try and fly over and participate and see her and then fly back. And so that was how we had a good life together. And we both looked back on it and reflected with gratefulness and pride, and many times in conversations after we parted.
She strikes fans as generous and warm-hearted.
Beg pardon?
She strikes fans as generous and warm-hearted.
She had a big heart. She really did. She had a fiery temper, but she had a big heart.
Now, I'd also like to take you up to 94. In 1994, and I know you know that year, you chose not to endorse your Republican Party mate, Oliver North, in his run for Senate. And as our listeners know, instead you backed Marshall Coleman, the independent candidate. North and other Republicans, of course, were deeply disappointed to not receive this endorsement. Talk to us about why you didn't tap North.
Well, Coleman had served in public office in Virginia. I knew him quite well. I frankly didn't know North that well. And it wasn't that I tried to block North. I just had to make a choice between different people vying for the Republican nomination. And I decided to back Marshall, as I had worked with him while he was in public office. I knew him. And I didn't have an animosity against Oliver North. Oliver North was a very distinguished Marine. He had a wonderful record of service, public service in the Marine Corps, But there were other aspects of his life which I, you know, when he served as in the administration and various things that he did, I felt perhaps, you know, he had a split with Ronald Reagan. I've been always a great supporter of Ronald Reagan's. So anyway, that was a parting of the ways, but I really decided, and I am free to do that, support Marshall Coleman, and that I did.
Do you feel that you paid a price in a way that fellow Republicans felt that you couldn't endorse those in your own party?
Well, certain elements of the party backed Marshall. More backed Oliver North. I would agree to that. When you say pay a price, let me tell you, in political life, every day you have to make decisions. I always tried, and I think I fairly succeeded, to make decisions which I thought were in the best interest of our country, the best interest of Virginia, and then hopefully they coincided what I believed to be the best interest of the Republican Party. But there were times when there were deep issues and differences of opinion against what I did. But I was able to get, no other body in the Republican Party has done it, reelected five times. And so I just stand on the record.
You know, it's interesting because while you might have not curried favor with some of your GOP mates because of that lack of endorsement, you knew how to take the next steps. There was another election coming up. It was time for you to be reseated. And as the incumbent, you had the option to choose either a Republican primary or a Republican caucus. And smartly, you picked the primary because you kind of felt, well, I don't think I'm going to survive the caucus and my peers. Is that sort of how it happened?
Well, the option, the first place, the law was very clear. The state law was very clear that an incumbent could make that choice. And I made the choice right in the beginning because I like to have the broadest amount of support for my campaign. And you gained broader support by allowing anyone who so decided to go to the polls in that primary and cast a vote for or against me. But so that gave an opportunity for all Virginians who are registered to cast a vote and express their opinion with regard to the sitting Senator John Warner. And it did give a tremendous opportunity for a lot of folks that frankly concentrate on politics only about election time, as opposed to party people who really work around the year. And we're fortunate that the two-party system is strong in Virginia. That's very, very important to our democracy, to have a strong two-party system.
The strategy worked because you did defeat your Republican rival, James Miller, for the nomination.
Jim Miller, he was a very competent, able fellow, but he had not had any experience, you know, in the hustings and running for a big election like that. But he gave it his best.
Now, as we've reiterated, you served 5 terms, 30 years, which is absolutely remarkable. In these days of the internet and social media and winds changing favor at every day, do you think that today's lawmakers have an equal shot at that kind of longevity?
Frankly, I think that the era where you can get elected 5 consecutive times has been narrowed substantially. I remember just a few months ago the graciousness of the General Assembly of Virginia. Speaker Howell invited me down to join a fellow Washington and Lee classmate, Lacey Putney, who is the longest-serving member in Virginia history of our General Assembly in the House. He's the longest serving. I was the longest serving in the Senate, Republican, of course, but second to Harry Byrd Sr. And it was quite a celebration that the General Assembly gave us there, just for a short time on the floor. But I reflected on just what you said, and I said in my remarks to the General Assembly, I doubt ever again that the two persons will stand before you with such long careers in their respective bodies.
The time was right. The person was right. You made, as you talk about those decisions that you make on a daily basis, obviously you made the right ones.
Well, I think I probably did.
Now, interestingly, I want to talk a little bit about some social issues. You were considered pro-choice. And although you have also voted for some abortion restrictions, it is very rare for any Republican to be identified as in favor of a woman's choice.
Well, I'm not sure I'd use the word rare, but basically the conservative elements of the Republican Party feel very strongly on the issue. I just think each individual should be sort of free to make up his or her own mind on that. I value life greatly. On the other hand, I respect, and through the years I've really been strongly of the view that a woman has a special responsibility and a very special duty unto herself and her family and other loved ones and others to make the right decision which is best for herself. And therefore, I just think that you shouldn't put laws out there that take away that right from a woman.
You were also more moderate than most Republican senators from the South when it came to gun control laws. You voted for the Brady Bill. And in 1999, you were one of only 5 Republicans to vote to close the so-called gun show loophole.
Well, I did, because from my childhood, I never will forget, my father on my 12th birthday gave me a shotgun. And I was about the only kid on the block that was given by his parent a gun. And my father said he would be. My father had been in World War One in the trenches as a doctor, and he was a soldier at heart. And he drilled into me the responsibility and accountability, which helped me in my careers in the Navy and then the Marine Corps. That is my period of time. And guns have been a part of my life. I had a large gun collection when I had a farm and used to hunt a lot, and I don't do as much anymore, but I still have remnants of my collection, just a few old cherished pieces. But I respect the right, the constitutional rights that people have, but again, I believe that we've got to, as a society, occasionally make some sacrifices to make the lifestyle of the others safer. And I do think that the gun situation has gotten to the point where there's such a proliferation of weapons, and look, guns are made for protection and for personal pleasure as hunting and target shooting and other things. May that always be. But somehow we got to recognize that, unfortunately, there's an awful lot of trafficking among people who have literally no or much less responsibility towards the other fellow man or woman than do we.
I appreciate your shedding light on some of these issues. I want to be sure to get some time in to find out, what is John Warner doing now? What are you up to?
Well, I was fortunate to go back to a law firm where I'd started many, many years, 32 years ago, and I'm pretty much allowed to do as I please. I represent, as I said, I'm proudly representing the Pew Foundation on issues of energy. I'm concerned about energy, and energy has a direct relationship to our national security. I'm not here to give speeches on that. And I love the environment and trying to preserve it as best we can, and for future generations. And I'm doing those things that I enjoy to do. And I exercise 3 or 4 times a week, because that's very important when you become an octogenarian, to keep your body strong and your mind strong. And I sort of do what I want. I've got a lovely wife who cares for me and disciplines me quite properly to do this and do that, take good care of myself. Children come down. I got grandchildren, so I have an enormous good fortune. And I just, when you talk about me, just always remember, I am humble. I am a lucky, lucky individual for all the marvelous opportunities that have been given me. I've gotten more of my share of good luck.
Your staff endorsed that. One of your staff members told us that you shy away from the limelight, and that's
absolutely
not what you're seeking.
I'm not sure why I'm doing this, except I'm a great supporter of public television and public radio.
That's a great plug and a great way to wrap. A distinguished senator for 30 years and Secretary of the Navy, Senator John Warner.
Thank you very much. Let me tell you, I do this with a great sense of humility and gratitude to all those who made my life and career possible.
Thank you. A distinguished senator for 30 years and Secretary of the Navy, Senator John Warner.